Welcome to the Dr. Gundry podcast, where Dr. Stephen Gundry shares his groundbreaking research from over 25 years of treating patients with diet and lifestyle changes alone. Dr. Gundry and other wellness experts offer inspiring stories, the latest scientific advancements, and practical tips to empower you to take control of your health and live a long, happy life.
Sometime in the early 80s, REO Speedwagon's airplane made an unannounced middle-of-the-night landing.
This is my friend Kyle MacLachlan, the star of Twin Peaks. And he's telling me about how he discovered a real-life Twin Peaks in rural North Carolina, not far from where he filmed Blue Velvet.
What was on the plane was copious amounts of drugs coming in from South America. Supposedly, Pablo Escobar went looking for other spots, quiet, out-of-the-way places to bring in his cocaine.
My name is Joshua Davis, and I'm an investigative reporter. Kyle and I talk all the time about the strange things we come across, but nothing was quite as strange as what we found in Varnumtown, North Carolina.
There's crooked cops, brother against brother. Everyone's got a story to tell, but does the truth even exist? Welcome to Varnumtown.
Varnumtown is available wherever you listen to podcasts.
Before we dive into the research and highlights of Dr. Wall's book, The Wall's Protocol, I want to remind you that the tools we are going to discuss today are not to be used in place of other protocols recommended by your healthcare provider. It's important to first communicate with your doctor regarding any information you wish to put into practice, especially for serious illnesses such as multiple sclerosis. Okay, let's get started. Welcome to the Dr. Gundry podcast. You know, today I'm excited to welcome back Dr. Terry Walls, a renowned professor at the University of Iowa Carver College of Medicine, a best-selling author, and a true medical marvel. And she's not just a colleague, but a dear friend. Dr. Walls' story is extraordinary. After grappling with multiple sclerosis for over two decades, she catalyzed her dramatic recovery by transforming her diet and lifestyle. Her journey isn't just a personal triumph, though. It's a beacon of hope, proving that a fulfilling life is achievable despite chronic illness. In just a bit, we'll dive into some of her groundbreaking research, including an innovative study that's set to revolutionize our understanding and treatment of MS and other autoimmune diseases. And the best part? You'll learn how you can be a part of this groundbreaking work. So don't go away. We'll be right back. You're not going to want to miss this one. For those on my channel who don't know you or your story, can you tell us a little bit about your incredible health journey?
I'll sort of tell it in real time. We'll go back 23 years ago. I'm out walking with my wife, Jackie. My left leg grows weak, dragging it to hobble home. I see the neurologist the next day. And he tells me, Terry, this could be bad, or really, really bad. And I begin the workup. While I'm going through that workup, Steve, I'm thinking about the fact I've had 20 years of worsening electrical face pain due to trigeminal neuralgia. And so I'm like, oh my God, this is a progressive disease. I don't want to become disabled. So I'm secretly praying for a fatal diagnosis. 3 weeks later, I hear multiple sclerosis. I do my research. I find the best MS center in the country. I take the newest drugs. 3 years later, I hear tilt, recline, wheelchair. I've adopted the paleo diet. I'm continuing to decline. I take mitoxantrone, a form of chemotherapy. It does not help. I take Tysabri, the new biologic that we're all so excited about. It does not help. I'm switched to Celcept. And that's when I ask myself a really important question. Am I doing all that I can? I'm like, well, I can still think. So I start reading the basic science, going to PubMed night after night. I decide that mitochondrial dysfunction is what drives disability. I create a supplement cocktail for my mitochondria. It slows my decline. I'm very grateful, but I'm still declining. I discover a study using electrical stimulation of muscles. I ask my physical therapist, can I try that? He says it's painful. He could grow bigger muscles, but he's not sure my brain could talk to the bigger muscles. He might be making things worse. He gives me a test session, it hurts bad, but I feel really great afterwards. And so we add the electrical stimulation to the exercises. And I can do 10 minutes of exercise on the mat. If I do longer than that, I can't go to work and function. So I'm adding a little bit of e-stim to my little bits of exercise. I discover the Institute for Functional Medicine. They have a course on neuroprotection. I take that. I have a longer list of supplements, which I add. And then I have this big aha. And Steve, I sort of laugh at how long it took me to have this aha. Like, what if I redesign my paleo diet that I've been doing for 5 years based on this long list of supplements? What if I figure out where those ingredients are in the food supply? So that's a few more months of research. And I start this new way of eating December 26, 2007. Now, at that time, I want all of your listeners to know I am so weak, I cannot sit up in a regular chair as I am now. I'm in a zero gravity chair with my knees higher than my nose. That's how I staff clinic for the residents. That's how I take my meals at home. And I'm so weak, I can't go to the movies. I can't go out to eat. It's a struggle to drive the 10 minutes that takes me to get to work. And I start this new way of eating. Shockingly, by the end of January, I realized that my mental clarity is improving. My energy is improving. And my physical therapist says, Terry, you're stronger. He increases my exercise to 10 minutes twice a day, then 15 minutes twice a day, then 20 minutes twice a day, then half an hour twice a day. And then I start walking at the hospital with two walking sticks, stunning my colleagues, and then with one walking stick, and then with none. And then, in April, I tell Jackie, who's my wife, that I would like to try biking, which I've not done in 6 years. And she says, honey, if things keep going well, maybe in the fall. Well, 2 weeks later, I really want to try riding my bike. We have an emergency family meeting because my kids don't want me to do that. They don't want to risk my getting hurt. But Jack says, Zach, who's my 16-year-old son, Zach, you run alongside on the left. And she tells Zebby, my 13-year-old daughter, you run alongside on the right, and she'll follow. And we all get into position. I get on my bike, and I bike around the block. And that big 16-year-old boy, he's crying. The 13-year-old girl, she's crying. Jackie's crying. And as you can tell,
you're crying.
When I retell that story, I cry again, because that's the moment when everything changed. Because when you have a progressive neurologic disorders and secondary progressive MS, I was taught, and all of my neurologists told me, that in the progressive phase of the illness, there is no recovery. Functions once gone are gone forever. And I'm like, how much recovery might be possible? And so I biked a little bit more every day. And then in October, Jackie comes home and says, honey, I've signed us up for the Courage Ride. It's 18.5 miles. However far you go will be a triumph. Now, at that point, I just biked 8 miles. That was the furthest I'd gone. But I did it. I crossed the finish line. And once again, we're all crying. My kids are crying. Jackie's crying. I'm crying. And this fundamentally changes how I think about disease and health. It will change the way I practice medicine. And it will change the focus of my research. And I've made it my mission to teach other clinicians and the public, and to do the research to show that diet and lifestyle are critical for having a better outcome for people with MS and other neuroimmune conditions.
Back in 2008, your ideas, much like mine, were seen as unorthodox. In fact, I recently was on a podcast where my ideas and your ideas and my ideas are very similar. I think that's why we've become good friends. Those ideas were ridiculed, and that certainly is not conducive to a good medical practice or good medical advice. And yet, here you are. We could call it miraculous, but I think you and I think it is very different than calling it miraculous. There are things that happen that, we all have, luckily, some control over. If people are given the tools. So as this was happening to you, what did your colleagues say to you?
So at first, when they see me walking around, they're like, oh, my God, you must be on Tysabri. And I said, well, actually, I'm not. And, you know, my neurologist has taken me off all disease-modifying drugs. And this is all diet and lifestyle. And then I show my electrical stimulation device, which, you know, I was carrying around and stimming much of the day. And so they're thrilled until they realize that in my clinics, both the traumatic brain injury clinic, where I've been reassigned, and my primary care clinics, I'm now asking what they're eating and talking to them about diet and exercise. And so I've changed how I practice medicine. And I think it was probably about a year later, my chief of staff calls me into his office to say, Terry, we're getting all these complaints about you. What's going on? And by the way, I'd also been banned as a speaker by the MS Society, and he had heard about that. So it's like, what's going on? You're banned as a speaker? What's going on? Now, fortunately, I had known this was going to happen, and I brought with me a handful of scientific papers, and I was explaining what I was doing and why. And John said, well, but it's not the standard of care. You have to practice the standard of care. And I sat back and said, well, of course, John, send out an email to all the faculty that we have to practice the standard of care, that we can't use the latest science to guide our recommendations for patient care. And of course, I'll follow that. And I sat back and smiled. And I don't smile a lot. So. And so yeah, it felt like a long time. It was probably not that long. Then John goes, well, okay. But if anyone gets hurt, you're going through peer review. And I go, of course. We all go through peer review when someone gets hurt. And in the end, John became a huge supporter and champion. And he was actually very supportive when the chief of medicine at the university wanted me to conduct our first clinical trial, where we used the protocols I'd used for my recovery in others with progressive MS. And John gave me the clinical time away from practice, a couple days a week to do my trials. The university gave me space to do the trials. A PhD student who used our trial as her dissertation materials. And so we conducted that first study. The other thing that John did, which actually I am very grateful for now, said, Terry, you have to learn how to do this without pissing everyone off. So I'm going to send you to the Complementary Alternative Medicine Clinic at the university and to work with Dr. Nicole Nisley, because what you're doing is good, but you're upsetting people. And I think you're putting your medical license at risk. So I want you to learn how to do this safely, both for you, and for the patients, and for the BA and the university. So I went, and I did learn how to play better in the sandbox.
I'm going to have to go take that course as well, I guess. let's talk about these trials. You recently published a paper on the Swank diet, which I know about and you know about, versus the Walls diet study. So what was the standard of care for diet when all this came about?
So the standard recommendation is eat a healthy diet, whatever that is. Or it is that diet doesn't matter. Just take the disease-modifying drug treatments. Roy Swank was the very first guy after World War II who said, I think diet matters. And he made the observation that a low, very low-fat diet that people had to eat during World War II led to much lower rates of MS relapses and disease activity and slower disease progression. So he hired dietitians in his MS clinics and instructed them on a very, very low fat diet, less than 15 grams of saturated fat a day. So white poultry meat, white fish, lots of carbs. And he followed people. And he published on that cohort, started out with 250, ended up with 144. And of course, the problem is, the people that dropped out were probably non-random. So because he doesn't have a control group, he didn't have blinded assessors, you don't really know what to make of it. But I still have to put a lot of credence. He's the very first guy who says diet matters. Then there's the McDougall's study, which looked at McDougall diet, a vegan low-fat diet. They were not able to show any difference between the McDougall diet and a usual diet. Then we come along and we do a parallel arm comparing the Swank diet and basically the Walls elimination diet, which is very similar to the diet that you recommend as well. It's low in lectins. People had a 12-week observation period where they ate their usual diet. They came in. We did the assessments. We said, eat your usual diet, come back in 12 weeks. We repeated the assessments. Then we randomized them to either the Swank or the Walls, gave them 5 calls with a dietitian to learn how to implement this in their family. They came back for assessments. Then we let them in the Walls side begin to reintroduce ingredients one at a time. And then they came back again in another 12 weeks. So we had 24 weeks worth of intervention, 12 weeks of observation. During the observation period, you know, things didn't improve. Fatigue got worse, quality of life got worse, anxiety, depression got worse, and walking hand working memory did not change. What we saw when we did analyze the data, the Walls and Swank both reduced fatigue similarly for fatigue severity index. For the more sensitive measure, modified fatigue impact, Walls was better than Swank at 24 weeks, although they're equivalent at 12 weeks. For quality of life, Walls and Swank both improved at 12 and at 24, although Walls was significantly more improved at 12 and at 24. For mental health quality of life, Swank improved at 24 weeks, so it did not improve at 12. Walls improved at both 12 and 24, significantly more so than Swank at 12 and 24. Interestingly enough, working memory, Swank did better at 12 weeks than Walls, although Walls and Swank were equivalent at 24 weeks. Walking endurance, that is how far you could walk in 6 minutes, neither Walls nor Swank improved at 12 weeks. Probably not surprising because we said, don't add an exercise component because this is a diet study. We're trying to figure out what diet does. Surprisingly, at 24 weeks, the Walls group significantly improved their walking endurance, and it was clinically significant as well, although the Swank did not improve at 24 weeks. What I tell folks is both Walls and Swank were vastly better than the usual American diet. Walls was better than Swank for many of the measures, although not all. You can do a low saturated fat diet while you're doing a Walls diet. If you want to, you can certainly follow a low saturated fat version of the Walls diet if you wish. If doing the Swank diet has more appeal to you, and that's what you and your family can do, that's what you should do. But if you want the diet with the largest effect size, that would be the Walls diet.
Well, that's fantastic.
Yeah.
What do you now teach your neurology residents with this information?
You know, there was a really lovely study that Dr. Snetzler did, who looked at all of the diet studies that had been published that were randomized and had an outcome in fatigue or quality of life that had been published before May 2021. And with that, she found 12 studies, 8 diets, the anti-inflammation, Mediterranean, ketogenic, paleo, low saturated fat, fasting, calorie restriction, and usual diet. And for fatigue, there are 3 diets that were the mean, standard deviation, and 95% confidence interval are all on the side favoring intervention. And those 3 diets were the paleo diet, basically, the Walls elimination diet, the Mediterranean diet, and low saturated fat. And the paleo diet was about 50% more effective than the Mediterranean or low fat diet. For quality of life, and there's both physical health and mental health quality of life diets there are paleo and Mediterranean, with the paleo diet being twice as effective as the Mediterranean diet. So what I'm teaching residents in neurology, what I'm teaching residents in internal medicine is that diet matters. It's easiest if you can do it as a family, but clearly the most effective diet is the paleo diet. A Mediterranean diet would be my second choice. But for clinical reasons, there may be times that I will say a ketogenic diet is a better diet choice because of type 2 diabetes, severe obesity, more cognitive issues. There may be times I'm going to be more into stressing low saturated fat. There are times that what people can more successfully do might be intermittent fasting. So I want to listen to the patient and the family, because the people who are successful because the whole family does this. The people who struggle are the ones who say, the person with the disease will change their diet. Everyone else will keep eating the standard American diet. That's a recipe for a struggle, relapse, and finally giving up, saying, diet doesn't matter.
Yeah, I think that's very true with my patient population as well. It makes a huge difference if you can get the family on board, because one of the biggest complaints is, well, gee, you know, I have to cook this meal for me, or I have to eat these foods, and everybody else is, you know, eating wonderful garbage, which I really want to eat.
We spent a lot of time on behavior change. It was at the time that I had this transformation and changed how I practice, I'm in the VA system. So I can't do any functional medicine testing, none, which at the time really annoyed me. But now actually I'm so grateful that I couldn't, because my only tool, Steve, was behavior change. And what I learned was that we could in fact be enormously successful with behavior change. My VA partners saw my amazing results. The chief of medicine called me into his office, and I thought I was going to get another dressing down for, you know, not playing nice. And it was like, Terry, I'm pulling you out of primary care because I want you to have your own clinic. We'd like to send the most difficult people to you. So I said, oh, okay. So we created the Therapeutic Lifestyle Clinic. I went to specialty medicine, primary care, and the pain clinic. And I said, give me your toughest cases. We won't be prescribing any drugs. This is all diet and lifestyle. And I worked with dietitians, health psychologists, physical therapists. And over time, we created what I now call the Walls Behavior Change Model, which incorporated what I learned from my research, my own clinical personal experience, and what my vets taught me were the elements to successfully changing behavior. And so, you know, we were extraordinarily successful. I would say we had an 80 to 85% response rate in our clinic, where people would actually make these dramatic changes in their diet and sustain that. And so I would get to come back to my specialty pain team, medicine, chief nurse, chief of staff, the chief of the hospital, and report our success with improvements in A1C, improvements in blood pressure, improvements in BMI, reduction in narcotic use. And we were extraordinarily successful without drugs, with only the very basic primary care labs. You know, things like an A1C, insulin, vitamin D, lipids. And after having the previous couple of years using these concepts in my traumatic injury clinic, where I got no labs whatsoever, it felt very luxurious to finally get to have even if, you know, just a few labs.
You mentioned that this was a number of years ago. You were getting a fasting insulin level. I have third year family practice residents rotate through my clinic, and none of them have ever heard, I kid you not, of measuring a fasting insulin level. None of them.
It is shocking. Poor metabolic health is such a driver of so many disease states. In my population, people with multiple sclerosis, poor metabolic health, insulin resistance, metabolic syndrome, prediabetes, diabetes, accelerate disease processes. And I should also tell you that in every one of my studies, metabolic health improves. Insulin sensitivity improves. Of course, you and I are completely not surprised by that. My neurology colleagues are like, they struggle because they can't imagine, one, eating all these vegetables, and two, giving up gluten, you know, giving up all of the ultra-processed, flour-based products.
Yeah. The Dr. Gundry podcast is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Whether you love true crime or comedies, celebrity interviews, news, or even motivational speakers, you call the shots on what's in your podcast queue, right? And guess what? Now you can call the shots on your auto insurance, too. Enter the Name Your Price tool from Progressive. The Name Your Price tool puts you in charge of your auto insurance by working just the way it sounds. You tell Progressive how much you want to pay for car insurance, then they'll show you a variety of coverages that fit within your budget, giving you options. Now, that's something you'll want to press play on. It's easy to start a quote, and you'll be able to choose the best option for you, fast. It's just one of the many ways you can save with Progressive Insurance. Quote today at progressive.com to try the Name Your Price tool for yourself and join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. My new book, Gut Check, will be out in a couple days as we speak. And one of the things I've been doing now for a number of years, with 80% of my practice is autoimmune disease, as you probably know. People who have been to six or eight clinics or doctors, and yeah, they're on biologics, or they're not working, or they're just fed up with not being taken seriously. But interestingly enough, 100% of my patients with autoimmune disease have antibodies to the various forms of wheat, rye, and barley, whether it's about 98% of them have wheat germ agglutinin antibodies. 100% of them have gluten antibodies, gliadin and glutenin. 100% of them have non-wheat protein antibodies. 100%.
Yeah.
And these are people, a lot of these people have been gluten-free for even 10 years, and they still have very powerful antibodies. Now, the good news, I think, that you and I recognize is when we fix the problem, which in my opinion, and probably your opinion, is intestinal permeability as a part of this process, all these antibodies disappear. By a year's time, none of my patients have antibodies to the various forms of wheat. They're gone. The immune system's been retrained. And the good news is these people don't have intestinal permeability anymore.
It takes a long time for conventional medicine to change. It will certainly take a long time for society to change. You and I are accelerating that because of your podcast, your books, my books, so that the public, when they're ready, the teacher appears, they're like, okay, I am ready to consider that maybe I should be doing the diet and lifestyle factors. Unfortunately, what I'm seeing, and I'm guessing you're seeing this too, Steve, that because of the pandemic, the number of autoimmune related diseases are dramatically increasing. And I think that is part of the consequence of the increased activation of the innate immune system, the increased number of auto antibodies that are being generated, and therefore tissue damage to a variety of end organs. And so there's certainly more MS and neuroimmune conditions. And in the MS world, it activates our microglia. And so if you have MS, you're more likely to have what we call the pseudo-relapse, an increased flare of MS-related symptoms that may linger for many months and can lead to a worsening level of function, worsening disability.
I published this about 90% of my autoimmune patients, their markers resolve, return to normal, and their functional status returns to normal. But about 10% of them, and a lot of them are late in the process, they're definitely better, but they still have issues. And that's actually one of the reasons I wrote Gut Check, is I want to find out why that 10% in my practice is better, but they haven't fixed themselves, or I haven't fixed them, or whatever the word is. But you're right. There's, if you catch it early, this is good stuff.
Early is much easier. Late is much harder. Yeah, I think it's rather like Alzheimer's.
Yep.
Mild cognitive deficit, we can certainly get people back pretty close to normal cognition.
Yep.
Early Alzheimer's, we can get them close to normal cognition. Late Alzheimer's, pretty tough.
No, I agree. Yeah, there's these windows of opportunities, and maybe I think the important part that everyone should know, and Dale Bredesen, of course, preaches this, is, you know, let's catch this early and not say, oh, you've got Alzheimer's and there's no hope for you.
I want people to know that the windows that we're talking about are actually fairly long. For the prodrome autoimmune, that's usually a 5 to 10 year window.
Yeah.
For the prodrome, before you get the autoimmune diagnoses. And then if we can get to you early, preferably before the age of 40, the probability that I can get you close to good health is very high. If I'm going to see you in your 50s, I can improve your quality of life. I can improve your function. I don't know how close I can get you to really good health, but I can certainly improve your quality of life, and I can stop the decline. It's very rare that we cannot achieve that.
You've got a new study that's going to dive deeper into.
Yeah, I am so excited about our new study.
So tell me about that. And can people participate in this?
Yeah. We are still looking for folks. So this is for people with relapsing remitting multiple sclerosis between the ages of 18 and 70 who are willing to be randomized to either a ketogenic diet, a modified paleo elimination diet, or usual diet. You have to be willing to come to Iowa at month 0, month 3, month 24. Our primary outcome is quality of life. We're also going to look at fatigue, anxiety, depression, walking function, hand function, working memory. And Steve, we're going to get MRIs without contrast at month 0 and month 24. And we know that people with MS, as a group, our brains are shrinking 1% per year, which is terrible, which is why we have more anxiety, more depression, more cognitive decline, more frailty, more and earlier nursing home care. In my clinical practice, and just as I'm sure you see as well, we do a great job of getting rid of brain fog, of improving mental clarity. And so I am very, very hopeful that our intervention arms will be able to get to healthier rates of aging, brain volume loss, less than 0.3% per year. I should also say, in the control arm, the usual diet arm, we are giving tips once a month on how people can improve their diet. And people who are willing to be in diet studies all want to improve their diet. So in fact, I anticipate all three arms are going to improve their diets, and that all three arms will have some improvement in their brain volume loss. This will be the largest, longest diet study that's been done with MRIs. We're also collecting blood at each time point, so we'll be able to do biomarker analyses as well. We are very excited. I've got 120 folks in. Wow. I still have another 36 that I'm trying to recruit. I anticipate I'll be able to get them in sometime in 2024. We'll have all of our data collected by the end of 2026. We'll be data cleaning and then analyzing our data in 2027 and presenting it presumably in the fall of 2027 and having the manuscripts out in 2028. And so I'll be back to talk with you about that.
This is a great idea. It's a huge study. So we'll definitely include a link in the show notes.
Yeah, it's an easy link to remember. TerryWalls.com/MS study.
That's an easy one to remember.
Yeah.
Since we talked about that, maybe people, I hope, who follow you or me know kind of what an elimination diet is, but for those who don't.
Oh, sure. So we take out the foods that have the highest amount of food proteins that irritate our immune system. So grains, legumes, nightshades, and also put eggs in there. In dairy. So grains, legumes, nightshades, eggs, and dairy. Those are the big categories. And we have, you know, our dietitian helps people think through meals now. We also have, we have a diet app for the keto arm, for the paleo arm, to help people identify recipes, and they can search for lunch, breakfast, supper ideas. They can search for recipe ideas featuring a particular food ingredient that gives them the recipe, tips on cooking, meal planning. Our study participants have found that to be a very, very helpful tool.
All right. Now, having grown up in Nebraska and you're in Iowa, what you're proposing goes against, I think, the state constitution of both Nebraska and Iowa.
Yeah, that would be true. Although we giving up grain, giving up dairy, you know, I grew up on a dairy farm. That's certainly a big deal.
Yeah, I want to echo that. And I write about that in Gut Check. Initially in the plant paradox, I allowed pastured eggs or omega-3 eggs, but I eliminated casein A1 dairy and I allowed casein A2 dairy. But the more food sensitivity testing I do, and I do it on almost everyone now, people with autoimmune diseases, you're right,
they'll do certainly much, much better without them.
Yeah.
Now, after their gut is healed, their autoimmune systems are quiet, at some point in the future, be able to tolerate these foods, we find that the answer is sometimes yes.
Yes.
So I recommend they take them out for 6 months. In my practice at the VA, I propose 6 months and I negotiate with the vet. And sometimes all I could get was 2 weeks. Like, okay, if that's all you can do, start there. And they take them out 2 weeks. So, but when you reintroduce the foods, do it one ingredient at a time. So if you feel bad, you know which ingredient it was. And often in 2 weeks, taking the food out and then eating it again and realizing how terrible they now felt after having their breakfast, bacon, eggs, and toast, like, oh my God. I do feel terrible. And they take it back out. For many, we have to experience that pain to know, like, okay, it really is worth giving up this immediate pleasure of how tasty these foods are. And I acknowledge that, yes, the grains are tasty. Yes, cheese is tasty. Yes, bacon, eggs on toast, very tasty. I agree. I love those. But the principal investigator of your life, take them out for the length of time that you're willing to take them out, and then retest and eat them and see how you feel. And many of my vets would come back and would do group visits. So the vet would have their experiment, reintroduce the food that they loved and missed, come back and would tell their buddies, like, oh my God, you know, I had my eggs and toast and, like, oh my God, I felt so terrible. My joints hurt so much. I'm taking them back out. Doc is right. These are not good foods. They're not good for me. Vet telling the other vet sitting around the room was far more powerful than Dr. Wall saying that, you know, this food is not going to work well for you guys.
Yeah, no, that's true. Early on, I had a patient come back for the second appointment. I said, hey, you know, how you doing? He says, you know, feeling well never tasted so good. And I thought that was a great description because, you know, we're asking people to give up a lot of their favorite foods.
And it is hard. You know, biologically, our brains, we so value immediate pleasure so much more than future benefit. And so we have to acknowledge that we're asking people to do something that is biologically really, really hard. Giving them the permission, sometimes it's very helpful to, like, okay, run the experiment, take it out for as long as you're willing to take it out, and then put it back and see how you feel. And then I have to pray that I hope they feel really bad. So now it becomes more believable to them. Because if they don't feel bad, then like, okay, this is just not going to work. They're not ready to forego that pleasure.
I actually just saw that this week, a young woman with recent onset Crohn's, and she failed biologics and ended up in my clinic. And the good news was her bloody diarrhea and bloody bowel movements and 20 bowel movements a day subsided, became normal. This went on for about 6 months. She literally last week sent me some pictures of her toilet and with blood in it. And she said, this has started all of a sudden. What's going on? And I said, well, you know, get in here. She lives nearby. And I said, you know, you've been great. Was there anything happened in the last couple of weeks that you did differently? No, not a thing. I said, are you sure? Think back. And she said, and her mother was actually with her. And she said, well, wait a minute. On, you know, Christmas Eve, we celebrated and you had a goat cheese quesadilla. And she said, oh, you're right, I did. And I said, so when did this start? They said, day after Christmas. And I said, make any connection? And she said, yeah, now I do. I said, well, what did you do that for? And she said, well, it was Christmas. And I said, well, you just did a great experiment. Now, she's fine now. Mm-hmm. But
yeah, it is so helpful when people have pain. That is easier for them.
Yeah.
If they have a sensory disturbance, so my optic neuritis patients, it's easier for them. People who have motor problems, they're falling, can't use their hand, that's easier. If it's mood, anxiety, or depression, that's much harder. Those can be more subtle.
Yep.
Anxiety is easier for people to recognize. Depression is harder to recognize because it may show up as irritability. And so you're pissed off at the world. You think it's all their fault. And that can be the hardest.
I want to talk about what do you tell patients or our listeners, particularly as a female, how do you advocate for yourself in the current medical system?
Well, I let people know that I want them to continue to work with their conventional team.
Yep.
And their primary care team, because as they implement the concepts that I teach, their need for prescriptive meds will probably decline if you're on psych meds. And if we don't adjust them down, you may become manic and make really bad decisions. If you're on high blood pressure or blood sugar meds, those meds may need to come down. If you're on immune suppressing drugs, that's a more nuanced conversation. And I remind people that I want you to have a great clinical response. And we don't know, does that mean you have to have a 12-month or a 36-month response before you begin transitioning to a less potent disease-modifying drug with fewer side effects. And I remind them that they are the one who consents to putting drugs into their body. So if you've had a great clinical response and your specialist says, yep, you're doing great, you can decide, and my preference is that you go 2 years before you start transitioning to a less potent drug, although many of my patients are like, they're ready to go at 12 months. They can advocate, say, look, I'm not going to agree to that drug. I will agree to a less potent drug with fewer side effects. So I'm happy to transition. But we are the ones who give consent to take these drugs. We can say we're not giving consent anymore. We want a different drug. The physician may say, I can't take care of you anymore if you won't take the drugs I want you to take. And that's the physician's right. Then you may have to go find another physician. But I work hard to let my patients know that we don't have to take drugs, that we can choose to insist on a drug with a lower side effect profile.
Great advice. It's in the end, it is your body that we're talking
about. It's your body. Now, the physician can say, I can't take care of you if you won't follow my advice. That's the physician's prerogative. And then so you may have to go find another practitioner. Yeah. Most physicians are willing to work with patients, say, okay, we'll find an alternative drug that is somewhat less effective, safer, and we can begin that process of seeing how far we can go.
If you can't find the physician who will do that, then you need to look for another physician.
Yep, you may have to go find another one.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly.
And you know, the other thing that's very exciting, more and more, at least in the neurology world, more and more physicians are saying, you know what, diet and lifestyle really do matter. And we can get people to less potent drugs. You know, a lot of my integrative neurologists, they'll transition people onto Copaxone, which they may feel uneasy about having them off DMTs entirely, so they'll try to get them to stay on Copaxone. But if people continue to do really well, they are like, well, I guess we'll let you go off your Copaxone now and just keep getting your surveillance MRIs, which I do endorse.
All month long on Pluto TV, stream the biggest Tyler Perry movies free. Watch your favorites like Madea's Witness Protection and Madea's Big Happy Family. Join Tyler Perry as he goes on a couples retreat with Sharon Leal in Why Did I Get Married? Or Idris Elba and Gabrielle Union in the Tyler Perry-directed film Daddy's Little Girls. Plus, Pluto TV has hundreds of channels with thousands more movies and TV shows available on live and on demand. Download the free Pluto TV app on all your favorite devices and start streaming now. Pluto TV. Drop in. Watch free.
All right. I warned you that there's an audience question coming up. So this question is from Eileen945 on YouTube. She actually watched our last interview together where we talked a lot about the Walls diet protocol. And she wants to know, how does this Walls protocol fit into the whole plant paradox lifestyle?
You know, I think we are remarkably similar. We both endorse that lectins are a problem, and that adopting a low lectin diet is very, very helpful. In the Walls protocol, in my book, I give people a stepwise progress to go from the standard American diet to the level one Walls diet, to the more paleo Walls diet, to a keto diet, and the reasons that we want people on a keto diet, to the elimination diet. And that there are people who would do well to start with the elimination diet, particularly autoimmune disease involving the joints and the bowels. But I recognize that's harder. So I give people a stepwise progression.
Our programs are very similar. I think you're still stuck in the Midwest, and I know you're a beef and pork fan. And in my new book, I come down really hard on beef, lamb, and pork, harder than in the past.
Okay.
But you know, like I say, I got no dog in the fight. I'm from Nebraska. All right. Those are very good answers. Whether you want to follow Terry's books, my books, get them both, quite frankly.
Get them both.
Yeah.
I mean, they're great reading.
One of my favorite books when I was kind of starting on all this was Minding My Mitochondria by...
Oh, my God,
yeah. You remember that. Eat 7 to 9 cups of vegetables every day and watch your poops grow in size. I always refer back to your big...
It is good.
...big stools looking in the toilet.
It is good.
All right. All right. So thanks very much. Keep up the good work. Congratulations on the grandchild coming shortly, I guess.
We are very excited about that.
Yeah. And stay warm.
Sounds good.
Take care. All right. It is time for, if I can find it, the review of the week. This is from Jim's 11762 on YouTube. Just wanted to share. About a year and a half ago, I told a friend about the Plant Paradox diet. She didn't go on it at the time and has been a vegan for most of her adult life. 4 months ago, she was diagnosed with a tumor in her brain, and they told her to go on the Gundry diet. She did, and lost 30 pounds, and the tumor has shrunk 30%. Thank you, Dr. Gundry. This is great news. Jim, thank you for helping your friend. We've seen some remarkable changes in people with brain tumors by following this program. In fact, I wrote about one such gentleman in The Plant Paradox. I'm happy to tell you that that gentleman, who basically had an inoperable malignant brain tumor, no longer has one. And he's been cancer-free now for, I think this is his ninth year. His children will be graduating from high school this year. He's a single parent. And lots of good reasons for him to stay alive. And so this is possible. And thank you for giving me an example. And again, this is why I do this. And this is why I want to bring you the most up-to-date information that I can give you, because I'm Dr. Gundry, and I'm always looking out for you. We'll see you next week.
I hope you enjoyed this episode of the Dr. Gundry podcast. If you did, please share this with family and friends. You never know how one of these health tips can completely transform someone's life when you take the time to share it with them. There's also the Dr. Gundry podcast YouTube channel, where we have tens of thousands of free health insights that can help you and your loved ones live a long, vital life. Let's do this together.